I remember the first guy that I taught, he walked into this studio and very shy and very nervous. And I was also nervous going, like, did someone just pay me to teach him how to dance? What the hell? Do not let him on that this is potentially a scam. Like, there's no way he's paying me to teach him how to dance. But whatever. Let's roll with this. And he told me his story. He said, so obviously I don't know how to dance. Also, on top of that, I'm gay. And so everyone expects me to know how to dance. They think I'm a fantastic dancer. And he went, that is so far from the truth. I need so many shots of booze in order to, like, not, you know, get lost in my thoughts, not feel embarrassed because I know I'm embarrassed myself, to not know that people are staring, wondering, why can't this gay man dance? And for the first, I don't know, half hour of the lesson, he was staring down at his feet. Like, his head, his whole body was basically in that of shame. Just, like, shoulders caved in, head down, arms crossed, as if he was literally guarding himself from being attacked. And he started learning a few basic moves, like very simple moves, and it started to feel good. And once he got the moves and he started doing it to the beat, and he noticed that, he's like, okay, cool, it's going to the beat. And then his shoulders relaxed, his arms relaxed. And I remember he looked up at the mirror in front of him, and then he smirked. He smiled and went, what's up? He went, oh, I think I can, I'm beginning to learn how to dance. I think I can dance. I went, damn straight, you can dance.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. This episode of the podcast is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you yourself have aspirations to start a podcast, write a book, start a music album, whatever it might be, any sort of creative project of some sort, usually the first step in beginning that creative project is building a website. And fortunately, thanks to our friends at HostGator, building that website doesn't have to be complicated because they have an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy. They have 24/7 live support if you get stuck in the process. And they're providing 30% off to all Unmistakable Creative listeners. All you have to do is use the promo code creative at checkout for 30% off. Again, visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off at checkout. Now, let's say that design of that website is something that you find intimidating, or you don't happen to be a designer, or you don't think you can design logos. Well, that's where a service like our other sponsor for today's show, DesignCrowd, comes in. And the way DesignCrowd works is whatever your project is, you go to DesignCrowd, you submit your design brief, and you'll get submissions from anywhere between 60 to 100 different designers from around the world. If you like what you can get, if you like what you received, then you can approve payment. If not, you can actually go back to the crowd and ask for more, or you can ask for your money back. And because you're an Unmistakable Creative listener, you're getting $100 off your first design project. So visit designcrowd.com/creative and use the promo code creative for $100 off your first design project. Ben, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thanks for having me, Srini.
Yeah, it is my pleasure to have you here. So, you know, I came across your story actually by way of one of our listeners who somehow found a TED Talk that you did about dancing and using dancing as a way to build confidence. And I looked at it, and, you know, like, I get a lot of things sent to me, but for some reason I couldn't stop watching this TED Talk. It just made me laugh. It, you know, I was like, okay, this is just a really cool story. But before we get there, I want to start with, you know, a question that I've been known to start with, and that is, what do you think it is, you know, from early childhood, like an experience, a memory, or something that planted the seed in your mind for what you eventually ended up doing with your life and your work?
Huh. The first memory that pops into mind is fourth grade Catholic school in Brooklyn. Wasn't raised Catholic, but my family thought that, you know, Catholic school, good education. So I went there, and for recess, all the guys would normally be playing sports. They'd be playing football, basketball, something along those lines. And instead, with my little posse of two other kids, Jonathan and Ethan, we'd be playing pretend. We would be acting out scenes and whatnot. Superhero, Spider-Man, Batman, etc. And that was pure bliss for me. And I just remember from that point onwards, in long car rides, because we often took cross-country trips, I would have my Discman, my Sony Discman, and I listened to songs in there, and I'd always imagine action scenes. With every song I hear, I would see this, you know, Jackie Chan style action scene play out, and I just thought that would be the coolest thing in the world. And I never thought of it as like a career. I just thought of it as, oh, this is what happens when you listen to music. You imagine, you know, people kicking ass and taking names. Uh-huh. And somehow that led to learning how to dance, which was something that frustrated me for a while, which was because I would hear music, but I just didn't know how to move to it. It would, like, you feel that rumble in your belly, that like creative burn, and I just couldn't manifest it. And so after several years, I finally learned how to dance. And although I wasn't kicking ass like Spider-Man and whatnot, I could still, you know, move to the music in a way that felt badass. So that's kind of what, how it all started from fourth grade playing pretend.
Okay. Well, one question about this. First, do you remember what the very first CD or album that you owned was?
Holy crap. All right. So this is going to A, out my age, and B, be very embarrassing. My first introduction to music was through my cousin, and she loved pop music. And okay. So naturally, she introduced me to NSYNC and Backstreet Boys. So probably my first CD was NSYNC's first album. So that's what I was rocking out to on those cross country trips to, you know, California and Grand Canyon, listening to NSYNC, Let Her Rip, acapella style. There we go.
Also people who dance. So not, yes. You know, strange coincidence or not.
Yes, they can dance. Justin Timberlake, that man can move.
All right, so here's what was really interesting to me, because like what I know about you basically is what you've told me and what I found from your TED Talk, which we'll link up in the show notes. But walk me through the journey from fourth grade to this. Like, how do you go from that moment of, you know, this love for music, this love of moving to music? Like, what has happened between there and, you know, how I found you? Because I can't imagine it was just sort of a straight and narrow path, because straight and narrow paths very rarely lead to destinations like this.
Oh, I think my mom is still asking this question to this day.
Don't worry, my mom asks it every day.
Asian parents. Yeah. Let's see. It honestly, I was on the straight and narrow, like, Asian path. I had all the good grades. I thought I would go to medical school. In middle school, my family would always go to Borders Bookstore every Friday, and I would go straight to the college guide section and memorize literally the, I think, Princeton Review top 100, whatever, college guides. So I was like on that path for a while. And by the time I got to college, I was a little sick of academia. And so I started taking these classes just for fun. And two of those classes included breakdancing and circus. And so I tried them out and thought this was kind of fun, and spent more time doing this stuff than actually attending class. And by my senior year, I was going to class maybe like once a week, twice a week. Mom, if you're listening to this, I love you. I swear I was studying hard. and I majored in philosophy. And by the time I graduated, I thought, I have no idea what I'm doing. And so a friend that taught me the basics of gymnastics and invited me to, you know, she introduced me to circus. She said, hey, I'm living in Seattle right now and doing circus stuff. You want to come out here and do circus? And so naturally, as a philosophy major, I wasn't going to be doing anything else. So I thought, yeah, why the hell not? I'll do some circus stuff for a summer just for fun. And I ended up living in Seattle for 3 years pursuing circus arts and performing circus. And during that time, I eventually got over my fear of dance, which is a story in itself, and then decide, you know, I kind of like this dance thing, I kind of like this circus thing, let's combine them. And I started doing performances that incorporate dance and acrobatics and clowning.
Wow. Okay. Multiple questions come from that. I think that the first one, of course, is, you know, there's no way, me being Indian, you being Asian, we can't get through this conversation without talking about our parents.
Of course.
You know, I have to ask you what this relationship with your parents is like, especially when you kind of have basically violated every, you know, sort of expectation. I mean, this is as far from med school as you could possibly get. So I'm curious what, you know, what that whole experience has been like with your parents.
You know, to be honest, it is still unfolding to this day. It's as you know, I imagine most relationships are. But in college, I was still gave the impression of I'm going on the right path. But that's when things started to get a little uneasy, and that I want to take a year off from college. I want to take time away from college because academia was not feeling fulfilling. It felt basically, I studied philosophy because I thought it would give me the answers to what living a good life could be, how I could live a good life. And I discovered philosophy didn't have the answers to it. And the more I pursued movement-related stuff, creative stuff like dance and circus, I found that more purposeful, more fulfilling. And so there's this discord. And so when I went to Seattle to do circus, I told my parents that, okay, this is just for the summer. I just need a little break from academia. And so they went, oh, okay, cool. Take a little break from academia. And then, of course, you know, grad school. And just as a little context, I'm mixed. So my dad is Caucasian. He's Scottish. And my mom is Chinese. And I've kind of internalized their own conflict, which is my dad was always about pursue, follow your gut, your intuition, your higher calling. And always stress that there's a difference between academia and your own education. And so I was following more in that line starting in college, whereas my mother, understandably, wanted me to live a respectable life, a stable life, a secure life. And so the more she realized that this circus thing is lasting longer, the more she got worried, the more anxious she got. And eventually I became the black sheep of my Asian family. Like literally they told my younger sister, do not become like your brother. There is still hope for you. Like make sure to study hard. So in no uncertain terms, I was the outcast, the one that did circus and dated questionable circus women. yeah. And even till now it's less frequent, but it used to be about once a week, the conversation of, so what about medical school? What about grad school? And it got to the point where my family was literally trying to bribe me to go to medical school. They said, we will take care of everything for you. We will pay for it. We will buy you a place in New York City. You will have a car. You will have Spanish wine. I don't know where the Spanish wine came in, but for some reason I thought that would be like a nice little bonus. Like you'll have booze, really good booze. But they were literally trying to bribe me to go back to medical school. And at first I was really pissed, like so annoyed. Like why would you insist on this? But from their perspective, it makes sense. They came over to the U.S. during the Vietnam War. When they came to the U.S., they were looked down upon. They were not respected. And so in their mind, they do not want me to have lowly work that I would someone could look down upon, someone could think less of, and that I would have a stable life that can provide for a future family. So it makes sense, but it took me a while to be calm with that. At first, I went, why won't you let me do circus? I love circus. Circus is great, and the women are gorgeous. I mean, circus is fulfilling creatively. So, yeah, that's... And it's still a conversation to this day, less intense.
You know, you probably have a pretty good shot at getting into med school, given your unusual background.
Maybe, if I wanted that, yeah.
Yeah. I have to ask about the circus because, yeah. You know, I think for most of us, like, you know, we're kind of, we hear the word circus and, you know, what comes to our mind is things like Ringling Brothers, like elephants and all the things that we've seen mm-hmm. on TV or experienced growing up as kids. But yeah. I'm really curious, like, what is the day-to-day life, you know, of somebody who is in a circus group like? What are your daily habits like? What are your routines? What are your social relationships like? You mentioned gorgeous women. So I want to do a deep dive into the life of, you know, what is the world of the circus? Like, it kind of give us, you know, take us into that world.
Yeah. So I moved to Seattle to work at a circus school since I never grew up doing gymnastics, but in college I took a few classes and turned out I had a slight aptitude for this sort of stuff. And so went to Seattle to like teach and then eventually to train to be a full-time circus artist. And so I was both teaching and performing on the side. And so the teaching part was just like a normal job, but my office happened to be three large warehouses with colorful bouncy objects all over the place. And when I say hello to my coworkers, they happen to be standing on each other's heads. And so like slightly different coworkers than normal. And the part that sticks out the most in my mind was the community. It is, for the most part, circus communities, you walk in and their first thing they say to you is like, hey, you want to come play with us? Like, it's, there's room for everyone. There is a specialty for everyone. There is space. There is not, it's not like ballet where there's a certain body type, or other sports where you need certain, I don't know, predisposed advantages. And circuses, there are people there that, let's see, a couple that they were medical researchers and then decide, you know, we want to be duo trapeze artists. And so they left that all behind, and in their like late 20s, early 30s, decided to pursue that. And so they were some of the people I hung out with. And it is just an extremely welcoming, playful, creative community, which is probably why I stayed in Seattle for so long, is that you walk in and it's a version of Cheers. Everyone knows your name and they're fun, playful, loving. And when you perform, you get to feel like a rock star. And so I think that's, at least that's what kept me for a while, the community and gain an opportunity to shine, feel like you're seen. And as for daily habits, I wish I could say it was, you know, a very elite, intense thing, but circus folk, nah, not really. It's, you know, you happen to come in at, you know, 10 a.m., 11 a.m., whenever you happen to wake up, you train a little bit, hang around, talk a lot, and then, you know, if you happen to be performing that night, you go, you get ready for rehearsal, you perform, depending on how Russian you are, maybe have a few shots beforehand, and get on stage, perform, people come up to you afterwards, cheer, applaud, hug, and then you go home and figure out what the hell you're going to do the next day.
What is the training like? I mean, what's involved in the training? Like, let's say somebody listening to this is like, okay, now I'm fascinated. I wonder what I can do to go get involved in the circus in some way or another. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I'm you know, working on a new book about creative habits. And the first thing mm-hmm. that came to my mind when you've been describing this is, huh, I should go in and take a class and experience this.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned gorgeous women. So that kind of was a selling point.
Srini, you have come to New York, Al. Anyways, we'll save that conversation for another time. But so yeah, habits. All right, so if someone wants to get into the circus, you would find a circus school, a pre-professional or professional training program. And it's, yeah, it varies from place to place, but I can at least speak to my own experience when I was training, which was I would wake up, go in, and you go through your warm-ups, your pre-habilitation, and you do lots and lots of drills. Like, that's so much of circus, in that you are trained to be able to perform that one skill, those three skills that either no one else can do or no one else can do it the way you do it. And it's just repetition after repetition after repetition. And you drill that over and over again. Like, my acrobatics coach, this 6'2", lanky Frenchman, and when he, like, normally acrobats aren't that tall. Normally they're, like, you know, much shorter. And yet when he would flip, it's like a cat, like no noise. And so when he trained me, he would tell me my homework for the week. And he would say, all right, now I want you to do 100 cartwheels every day, 50 backflips every day, a few hundred this, a few hundred that. And I thought first time I worked with him, I thought he was joking. He went, no, 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 that's what you're going to do. And I went, but why? He went, I want it so that if I were to smack you in the middle of the night awake, you could do it without any hesitation, without any problems. Like, it needs to be in your bones. And so a lot of circuses is drilling, 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 drilling. And then, you know, you're doing your flexibility, your strength training. So it also depends on your discipline. If you're doing, say, acrobatics versus juggling versus tight wire, but a large part of the time is spent drilling. And as for actual how much, it varies. Some people are old school, like my coach, and he would say, you do hundreds every day. So depends on how Russian and Chinese they are. If they're Russian and Chinese, God be with you. And I hope you have a good masseuse or chiropractor on speed dial. The more American, the more lax they'll be with, you know, the hundreds of repetitions and hundreds of push-ups and pull-ups. So it depends on what's your poison, what's your ideal form of pain and torture.
So what did you learn from circus about performance and about creativity?
Hmm. Let's see. Early on, when I was getting ready to perform my first solo act, I was drilling it over and over again, and I was terrified because I wanted to make it a clowning act. I wanted to be like Buster Keaton, this guy that has amazing physicality, and even though he doesn't say a single word, you feel him emotionally. And I was getting ready to create my first ever piece like that, in, you know, in homage to him, and I kept thinking, like, shit, like, what if this is just not funny at all? What if what I find funny, the audience is going to go, seriously, dude? Man, I need more drinks to watch this kid. And a buddy of mine, a juggler named Nikolai, he gave me the best advice I've ever received on performing, and one that I still keep to this day and actually tell the people that I work with. And he said, when you're on stage, just know the audience wants you to win. They are rooting for you. They are on your side. And so even if you mess up, like, smile, acknowledge it, because, like, they want you to win. And something about that really stuck with me. He just said, and similarly, the more you enjoy yourself, the more they're going to enjoy themselves. All you have to do is let them in. Have a blast, and they're going to have fun with you. You are opening up them up to your world of fun, and they will love you for it. That's all you have to do. And sure enough, that's kind of what did it for me and stuck in my mind since. So whether it's performing, whether it's just dancing, if you are having fun, you become a beacon to other people. Naturally, like, who doesn't want to be around the person that's having a blast, that is just beaming with light and joy? And so that's the thing that stuck with me the most. Just the more I have fun on stage, the more people are going to enjoy what they see.
This episode of the podcast is sponsored by our friends at HostGator. So if you yourself have aspirations to do something like write a book, to start a company, to record a music album, whatever it is, I have always said that starting a website is one of the easiest first steps. In fact, one of the things I also wrote about in a recent Medium article is why everybody should learn to build a website. It's one of those skills that will come in handy no matter what job you're at and could be used for a whole bunch of different things. It's even something that Scott Adams, who is the creator of Dilbert, mentioned. He said, you know, that is one of those skills that will always come in handy. And fortunately, our friends at HostGator can help you to get started because they're providing 30% off all their hosting packages for unmistakable creative listeners. And not only that, they have 24/7 live support and an easy-to-use website builder if you're not tech-savvy and don't want to get your hands dirty with programming. But if you like tools like WordPress, they have a one-click WordPress install. So visit hostgator.com/creative and use the promo code creative for 30% off at checkout. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, our new book, Unmistakable: Why Only Is Better Than Best, is now available on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, as well as on Audible. And rather than take it my word for it, I wanted to share another snippet from one of our listeners.
My name is Lisa, and I blog about minimalism and intentional living at creativeholistichome.com. I loved this book. I think that anybody who is a creative or working on any sort of project needs to read this book. For me personally, it helped draw me closer to my fears and understand them better. And once I was able to understand where my fears were coming from, I was able to work through it on a deeper level. I think the surfing metaphor is brilliant. And surfers and non-surfers alike can appreciate its connection to the creative process. I recommended this book on my blog to all my readers and all of my family and friends, and I will continue to refer to it whenever I feel fear welling up as I continue to create. I'm so thankful for this book, and I wish all the success in the world to Sereni. Thank you.
It's funny, I think of that, you know, from the lens of public speaking as well as even doing interviews, and I kind of feel the same way about it.
Yeah,
like, absolutely. I know when I'm not having fun because I've been, you know, obnoxious enough to cut interviews in the middle of them.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to ask you one other question. You know, you made a sort of pivotal decision to say, you know what, you're kind of at this crossroads of med school or the circus. And you're like, okay, despite a lot of external opposition, I'm going to go and do this crazy circus thing. Yeah. And I think that often we come to those kinds of crossroads in our lives over and over and over again. Like, every time we want to do something of significance that could alter the trajectory of our lives, we arrive at moments like that. And I am wondering why, based on your experience, you think people choose the more safe and conventional route.
You know, it's something I still wrestle with. And it's, even though I made that choice to pursue the unconventional route, it still came with a heavy dose of Asian guilt. like some serious Asian guilt. And so, at least from my background, my history, I can understand a little better why someone would choose a conventional route, in that, at least from like having immigrant parents, you don't want to let them down.
Yeah.
You know, they come to the US, they give so much, like they sacrifice so much. Like, I think about how much my mom sacrificed to give me the opportunities I had, and it pains me. It like actually pains me how much she gave up. And so I can understand why, you know, if you have parents, immigrant parents, like you'd want to do right by them, you know? So there can be that conflict between what do I feel called to do and what do I think would make my family proud, to do right by them, to give back to them, you know, for all the things that they gave, sacrificed for me. And in that context, it's, you know, it's very much understandable. And it's something I still think about to this day, you know, when my mom is asking me to, you know, again, pursue grad school, another route. And I just know that she doesn't want to see me suffer, mm-hmm. essentially, is what comes down to it. And so, in that way, I can understand why someone would choose a safer route, to not let their parents down, their family down, to know that they can give back and provide.
Yeah. What do you think enables them to choose the unconventional route? Like, what makes that possible as somebody who's done it?
Yeah. Well, I will be honest and say that what helped a lot was that I was across the country when I made this decision. Like, if I was having to face my mother in person, it would be a lot harder. But I was, you know, in Seattle talking to her on the phone. I'm trying to think what did it. And what made it easier to decide was, I guess this is really simple and nothing particularly mind-blowing, but just the joy in the work itself. Like, the more, it was the sense of trusting myself and knowing that I could both love my mother, love my family, be thankful for what they gave me, and still pursue something that makes me sing, to trust that I will be just fine, that I'll be all right, that I will be able to take care of myself. So it was knowing that it didn't have to be an or decision. It could be and. I could love them, do right by them, and live a life that I'm proud of. And saying it right now, I think, like, yo, young Ben, why did you not think of that? Is not like an either or sort of thing. You can do both, but man, that Asian guilt is insidious, dude.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm curious about you, actually, if you don't mind me asking, like, is this something you ever had discussion with your family?
Yeah. I mean, I have an entire section of my book dedicated to this. So yeah.
Well, in that case.
Yeah, no, it's something I think a lot about. My sister is a doctor, so I think about it plenty. So it's definitely on my mind. You know, my dad's a professor, my sister's a doctor. So like, I have this family that is very much on a conventional trajectory.
Yeah.
So, you know, like I always jokingly say, I think God made a sorting error by putting me with my family.
And what was your thinking as you were like in the early stages of growing your business when, you know, there isn't a massive success to necessarily show for? How did that those conversations go?
You know, I mean, I basically kind of made a half-hearted effort to find a job to appease them, to like say, okay, look, I'm trying. Yeah. And then of course my trying didn't lead anywhere. So it was conveniently my trying didn't lead anywhere. So it was like, okay, look, I've been to all these interviews. Nobody's hiring me. Why am I doing this? This makes no sense. So,
yeah.
You know, it was one of those things where I was like, this is just stupid. Like it was one of those things where I'm like, trust me, I know what I'm doing here, even though, it will be completely misunderstood. You guys will not be able to make sense of it, but it will work. You know, and it's taken a really long time, which is one of those things that it does. Mm-hmm. But So let's do this. I want to actually talk about the shift from circus to the whole dancing thing, which is how mm-hmm. I found out about you. Mm-hmm. You know, what sparked the interest in that, like to make that shift? And then I want to actually start talking about the work you do and like what kind of impact this is, because what drew me into that TED talk was, one, I always felt that I can't dance. And so I was like, okay, I really, because I remember you saying something like that. I related to that in that moment. I was like, God, I wonder like what an idiot I look like on the dance floor unless I've had a few drinks. So uh-huh. I was like, okay, I definitely have to talk to this guy. But let's start with kind of the shift from circus to doing what you do now. Like yeah. Where did that start and how did it start?
Yeah, it started about when I left Seattle to move to Montreal, which is circus mecca of the world. That's where Cirque du Soleil is located. That is where one of the top circus schools in the world is located. And I decided I wanted to move there and really surround myself with the best of the best, the top people of the world, to soak it all in. And I found myself completely miserable, injured, bedridden, because I couldn't move my neck anywhere without pain because of some dumb trick I was trying to pull. And I was noticing all these people that were at the top of their game and seeing, wow, I actually don't want to live this lifestyle where they are dependent on so many other people to be paid. There's so much outside of their control, and they aren't necessarily doing the art that they want to be doing. They are doing what is in demand, what the show needs, and they don't really get to see their friends and family that often. And that, on top of being injured all the time, I went, I am so tired of being injured at all times. Like, I feel like an old man at this point. And so I thought about different options, and I thought, all right, what if I try and, create a business, said every young know-it-all kid. And I decided, all right, I'm going to move back to New York City and pursue entrepreneurship. I don't know how to spell it. I don't really know what it means, but I'm going to pursue it. And so I moved back to New York, and I was at a bar with various other aspiring, budding entrepreneurs, and I was trying to go over some ideas for different things I can do, and jokingly I said, oh, what if I help men get laid through teaching them how to dance? I thought that'd be funny. And then both the men and women said yes, very sternly, very seriously. They went, yes, you should. And I went, huh. All right, and so I decided to test it out, and I thought at this point, it's such a brilliant idea. Everyone loves it. I will create a workshop, and people will come flooding to me. I will build it, and they will come. And as you probably already know, that shit doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And so it took a few attempts, but eventually I discovered that, yes, it is a decent idea with a market of men that could use this, and also that with some work, a lot of work, and learning how to market and sell, that it can be profitable. And it just felt like a nice way to overlap my artistic desires, creative desires, and also being able to, for the first time ever, create income on my own terms. And so that's kind of how it began.
Okay. Tell me about your first experience of teaching somebody how to dance. I mean, of course, that premise of, going to teach men how to dance so they can get laid. I was like, uh-huh. That is, like I said, I mean, what drew me into the story, I was like, wow, this is really unmistakable. Like, there's something really special about this. And, it wasn't sleazy in any way at all, but I loved the TED Talk so much. And, it was, like I said, recommended by one of our listeners. Tell me about the first experience of teaching somebody to go through this and kind of talk to me about the before and after of a person who's gone through this experience with you. That's what I'm really interested in.
Mm. So I remember the first guy that I taught, he walked into this studio and very shy and very nervous. And I was also nervous going, like, did someone just pay me to teach him how to dance? What the hell? Do not let him on that this is potentially a scam. Like, there's no way he's paying me to teach him how to dance. But whatever, let's roll with this. And he told me his story. He said, so obviously I don't know how to dance. Also, on top of that, I'm gay. And so everyone expects me to know how to dance. They think I'm a fantastic dancer. And he went, that is so far from the truth. I need so many shots of booze in order to like not, you know, get lost in my thoughts, not feel embarrassed because I know I'm embarrassed myself, to not know that people are staring, wondering, why can't this gay man dance? And for the first, half hour of the lesson, he was staring down at his feet. Like, his head, his whole body was basically in that of shame. Just like shoulders caved in, head down, arms crossed, as if he was literally guarding himself from being attacked. And he started learning a few basic moves, like very simple moves, and it started to feel good. And once he got the moves and he started doing it to the beat, he noticed that. He's like, okay, cool, it's going to the beat. And then his shoulders relaxed, his arms relaxed. And I remember he looked up at the mirror in front of him, and then he smirked. He smiled and went, what's up? He went, oh, I think I can, I'm beginning to learn how to dance. I think I can dance. I went, damn straight, you can dance. And it was that look of going from shame to just the faint flickers of pride, just like the beginning embers of pride, just like, oh, look at you, you handsome devil. Yeah, you can dance. It was that look on his face. And that was, that was just my favorite moment, that look of him going, yeah, I got this. I can move. I can feel good moving and look good moving at the same time. And that was, thankfully, my first experience teaching a guy to dance.
That was awesome. Like, I had this scene in my mind of, like, you know, if you've seen the movie Hitch, where you know what I'm talking about.
Like, that was my first dance lesson, actually.
I guess the other bigger question, you know, like, why is it this, where does this I can't dance narrative come from? Like, you know, I mean, I've told you that myself. Like, I actually believe that right now. And that's kind of what drew me into this story. But why is it that people feel so self-conscious about something like dancing? And you know, I'm curious, like, what, so you taught this guy. I'm curious, what are the other sort of changes that you've seen in other people's lives as a byproduct? Like, what are the unexpected changes? I mean, other than hopefully getting laid, which, you know, not that that's a bad change, but I'm curious, like, what are the unexpected things that have come about from this? And then let's go to that second. But first, you know, where does this whole sort of self-consciousness about dancing come from? Because we're not self-conscious about standing.
Right. Yeah, it's the reason why I even want to do this, and why I wanted to do it in the first place, was because I was the target audience. I was the target demographic. I couldn't dance for most of my life, and it was embarrassing. And what I found through teaching other guys is that it basically came down to feeling like you are looking less of a man the moment you try to dance. Like, oh God, I have just made a complete ass of myself, even though at the bar I'm standing there looking pretty cool with my, you know, diesel jeans and, you know, nice crisp white button down and my vodka martini. Like, I'm looking pretty good. I'm feeling pretty good. But there's this crippling, paralyzing fear that, like, the moment you step onto a dance floor, and if you don't know what you're doing, you will just completely emasculate yourself. Like, you will look like a fool. You will be laughed at. People will think that you are less powerful, less cool. And that's what I felt for most of my life, this feeling of, you know, I could be on the dance floor, or I could stab myself in the eye with a dull pencil. I'm not really sure which one is worse at this moment. Yeah. Public humiliation or, you know, self-inflicted pain. May I just go with the self-inflicted pain. And most of the guys I've talked to, every guy I talked to has the exact same thoughts going through his head on a dance floor. They're the thoughts of, I'm too stiff. I look stiff. I look foolish. I'm embarrassing myself. I don't look cool. I can't join in with my friends because, you know, I'm just going to stand out like a sore thumb. It's this feeling that as soon as I'm outed as not cool, I will not be part of the party. I will be made fun of. I will be ostracized and less of a man. And so every single guy that I've come across has used almost those same words to describe what they're feeling. Uh-huh. What goes through your mind?
A lot of those very things, like as you're describing that, I can't help but think of all the Indian weddings that I happen to have been at where, you know, like I'll see my mom glaring at me for not being willing to go to the dance floor. Uh-huh. Like, you know, if we happen to be at a wedding together, and it's like, oh, I'm like, I don't want to go to the dance floor because I, you know, I'm like, I can't dance like half these people. And yeah. You know, then you add Indian music into that and it's, you know, a whole other disaster. but yeah, I think I have a lot of those sort of same narratives. And it's funny because to me, the issue isn't a lack of being able to dance. It seems like what you're really solving is another problem, but you're using dancing as the mechanism to solve it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's basically therapy through dance.
Which I love. I mean, it's such a cool, you know, concept. So, which takes us to that other question. What are the unexpected things that you've actually seen as a byproduct of doing this with guys? Like, what are some things that have really surprised you in this process?
The part I didn't anticipate when first starting was how it affects their sense of belonging. And so first when guys came to me, I thought I was literally a doctor fixing some symptom. I have knee pain. Here is something to fix your knee pain. I don't know dance moves. Here are dance moves. I thought it was just simply because most of the guys, they would say like, oh, female friends, you know, they tell me to just relax and feel the music. But for most dudes, that's equivalent of being told, just relax and speak Russian. Just, you'll be fine. Just let it flow. Let the Russian flow. Yeah. And as dudes, you're like, seriously? You're going to tell me just relax and do something I can't do? You're the best. And so I thought I was literally just giving them dance moves so they can go and do dancing. But what I didn't expect was it helped them feel like they belong. Because for a lot of the guys, even though they would come to me first saying, like, I need to know dance moves, after talking to them, they would go, yeah, when I'm out at weddings or parties with friends, I want to feel like I belong. Like I'm literally good enough to belong. That, I can be with friends and have fun with them. And so even though they may say it's because of a girl or because I want to get laid, most of the time it's just the sense of wanting to belong. And after they learn dance moves, they would say, yeah, I could actually, you know, I'll give an example. One guy, we never actually met in person. He only learned from my online material. He said he wanted to learn how to dance in a year so that he could go to his sister's wedding and enjoy himself with family and friends. And I didn't expect this, but he actually emailed me a year later saying, so the wedding happened and I had a blast. Not only did I feel like I could join in on the fun, but people were approaching me. They want to dance with me. And they were commenting on how much fun it was to dance with me. And so that was the biggest surprise, the sense that guys felt like they belonged. And I mean, hell, we all want to feel like we're good enough to belong.
Yeah. Wow. So have you had guys who've ended up in relationships as a byproduct of their learning to dance?
I've had guys that have had some fun rated R experiences.
Okay.
As a result, I'll leave it at that. But I've had guys email me going, yes, or text me going, so this just happened and these women approached me. And at that point, the radio silence I take as a good thing. After they tell me that, you know, so-and-so approached them and they met so-and-so. After that, the few guys I've checked up with, they went, yeah, it went well. So I'm like, all right, cool, say no more. You're good to go.
Wow, that's really cool. All right, so let's, you know, kind of get away from sort of this part of it, and I want to ask you some questions that I generally ask a lot of people that I, you know, have interviewed. One of them is basically artistic influences in your life. I mean, you've mentioned circus, you've mentioned music. So I'm curious, you know, if you look back over the course of your life as you've done this work, what's one book, one music album, one documentary film, you can do one of each or only one, that has profoundly influenced your life that you'd want to share with our audience?
Let's see. First would be Hitch, just because literally that was my first ever dance lesson. I was getting ready for prom, which again gives my age away. And I wanted to learn how to dance. And so I literally watched that dance scene, Will Smith teaching, I don't remember his name, Kevin something.
Yeah.
How to do the two-step with the arms by the side. And so I did that for like several hours straight at prom. It was the starting point. So there's that. There's, what else is there? Book. One book I give out to most of my guys is The Charisma Myth by Olivia Fox Cobain.
Uh-huh.
And because a lot of dance is really just body language, and you know, doing, changing your body language to music, to a beat. That's really what it comes down to if you're talking about survival. And so I gave him that book because it's the way it's laid out in that book, it's not, charisma is something that you add on like layer upon layer. Like, all right, Brad Pitt does this with his arms and Will Smith does this with his legs. Most of the book is spent on what do you need to do to get out of your own way so that you can become the most charismatic version of yourself. And that's what I end up spending a lot of time with guys doing, which is like, let's just take away the things that are getting in your way from enjoying the music, because odds are there are going to be some songs that you really enjoy. And so let's remove those barriers. And the book is the same thing. Let's remove the barriers that keep you from being the most badass, sexy, charismatic version of you. So that's book. Music, it's hard to say. Yeah. Maybe NSYNC, just because, you know, it's what got me going.
One other question about the dancing piece. What's been the response from women to the work that you do? I'm very curious. Like, you know, I mean, I'm guessing you've gotten to talk, like, I mean, not just women in terms of how they respond to the guys, but responded to your work in general.
Surprisingly positive. At first, when I thought, I was a little embarrassed to even mention it to women. I thought I'd get these looks of like, who do you think you are? Or what, you're going, oh, you're one of those pickup artists, aren't you? And I'd get smacked across the face.
Yeah.
But it's been really positive. Most times they'd say, actually, there's some guy, I need to introduce you to most of my male friends. but I don't want to be like a door-to-door, you know, I don't want to be like thrust upon men like, you need this. But yeah, most of the women have been really enthusiastic, saying more men need to get funky on the dance floor. And I wish they knew that it really doesn't take all that much for us to have fun dancing with other guys, since most guys are concerned with what moves are doing, and it's, that is so far from the truth of what makes for a fun dance partner for women.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. So I have one last question for you, which is how we finish all our interviews at The Unmistakable Creative. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
Unmistakable. It's, I guess I'll put it in the context of dance, since the stuff that I spend with my guys doing is, I know every single guy, you included, Srini, has the potential to be a baller dancer, not because of technique or anything like that, but because, you know, when you hear those songs that just light the fire in your belly, the sense of like the, this holy funk spirit is just like brewing inside, like, I gotta, oh man, here's Uptown Funk, and like, oh, I want to lose my shit to this. Whenever you allow yourself to, even for a second, just let loose, let go of control for a little bit, it is absolutely stunning and beautiful, because it's you. You are sharing a piece of you. And so the people I find unmistakably creative, the dancers that I find creative, are the ones that that bleed in front of others. And not bleed in a bad way, but rather they allow themselves to be seen in the most raw form, even if there isn't good technique, even if it's off the beat, even if it looks weird, whatever it is, they are showing themselves. And to me, that just looks divine. They look like walking gods in those moments, or dancing gods, I should say. And to me, I find that just unmistakably creative. Like, you cannot help but watch and see someone glowing like that.
Well, this has just been awesome. This has been one of my favorite interviews we've done this year. It's just really cool. I'm so glad one of our listeners put your work on my radar. Where can people learn more about what you do?
They can go to MrBenWeston.com if they want to meet with me in New York City, or DanceFloorArsenal.com. Those are the two. Those are my two online homes.
Very cool. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Next time on The Unmistakable Creative.
Most days after school, we were home alone or with our friends, but we kind of, you know, had our own keys and came in and out of the house and, you know, made our own entertainment. And we'd get hungry around like 5 o'clock, and my mom was commuting back from the city, and some nights, you know, it wasn't with my dad. So we'd get hungry, and my brother had no instincts at all for cooking or working really with his hands. he could burn water, basically. And so, as the story goes, he's become a much better cook now. But at the time, I had a real interest for some reason. And somewhere between like 3:30 in the afternoon and 6 o'clock at night on PBS, local channel 13 and 21, were these great cooking shows. And I watched them as if I was like, you know, stay-home mom watching soap operas. I would, like, you couldn't draw me away from the television every day of the week.
Jeffrey Zurofsky and Sacha Twaina join us to talk about using food as a tool for building community.